Let me quickly introduce Sten Ludvigsen to you, the today's speaker. He's currently a professor in medical education at the Faculty of Medicine in the University of Oslo. And I know him for quite a while, and then he was a professor at Intermedia at the University of Oslo, and also the director of that institution that also had some was not a satellite but a collaboration partner at the University of Bergen with the same or similar name. So he started his studies in educational science with a specialization in educational psychology, and he quickly then specialized on digital learning resources and the relationship of co-located and distributed settings. So I think exactly what Freitas also pointed us to, this is a typical situation in nowadays workplaces, in most of our nowadays workplaces, and therefore, and Sten started with this research on that very early, I think when this was not the typical setting for work. From the very beginning, I think, of his career, but he will tell us more about that, he had some relations to medical education, but I'm also now curious what his new, professorship in medical education is bringing with it, so what his new tasks are. And also, of course, how he himself, or you, Sten, would relate your current work to the learning sciences. I will ask that also a bit later. So Sten, now the floor would be yours, and we are looking forward to a quick self-introduction by you, and then discussing your work.
Okay, Frank. First of all, thank you for the invitation. I think it's always very inspiring to work in the international learning science community and CSL community, and I learn mostly we use the term learning science community because I think it covers the both sub communities that's engaged, and there is a high overlap. First, my way into the learning science and CSL is was really starting with the try to understand how young physicians was trained in hospital settings and how they learned to do the profession, so to speak. And I understood quite early that it was really a question about how they were socialized into the both knowledge structures and what I would now would refer to as expert cultures. So that was kind of very important for me to see that the social and the cognitive aspects of the learning is very important to try to find ways of both theorizing about the relationship between the social and the cognitive aspects, and also find methodological ways of dealing with that. So that was kind of an important starting point. And I was very inspired by two articles written in the Learning Science Journal in back in, I think, in 1992. And that was written by Anne Brown and Ellen Schoenfeld, and they problematized the how we do studies of learning, and that we need to study learning over certain periods of time. And I think at Intermedia and my leadership, we took the idea of learning trajectories or interaction trajectories. We tried to look at the temporal dimension of learning and had that as a program for a number of years. I think that during those first years, I would see myself as a kind of a learning scientist back from the early 2000s. And then I was heavily engaged in the CSL community, where we had the CSL conference in Bergen in 2003. And then I think I've been visiting the Learning Science Conference and CSL Conference almost every time they have been organized. So to me, this is kind of our home community, where I think I can really engage with a high number of scholars, which I think do very interesting work. Also been quite heavily engaged on the European scene, as Frank said, in the Kaleidoscope Network of Excellence, and you get to know the whole kind of interdisciplinary technology enhanced learning field in Europe, as well as in the US and on other continents. So it's always very inspiring to work in this international field. I'll then move on to the session, and I hope that you have downloaded the PowerPoint, so you can follow the PowerPoint when I make reference to them. And as you see, I planned the kind of two or three small breakouts where the either if you are alone or you are sitting together in a group, can actually discuss and mobilize questions, comments, and I'd like to always to add if you have any objections to anything what I'm saying. Just shortly about the four articles, I picked one article that I was writing together with, she's actually my partner, so the first and only thing we have been writing together. We did that when we had sabbatical on Berkeley, so I will go a bit in depth in that article later. The three others was chosen of different reasons, and I took one review article that's not a typical kind of a meta-analysis based on statistics, but a review of a qualitative review, what you can call a configuration, a review about the field. So that's the kind of the CSCW review of ICT in the health. Then I was picking up, I think, a very interesting article by the by Dr. Pennington from Texas that looked at the e-science, which was really a hype in the some years ago, and I think she do an excellent job of kind of unpacking the wishful thinking and see what we actually can do if we want to establish an e-science system. It's not that, it's quite complicated to make it work, to put it that way. And the last article was, I picked Christian Greifenhagen because I think it's interesting to see that if you want to study processes, the question becomes what kind of details would you pay attention to? How do kind of sequences of action emerge and so on? And as if you have looked into the article, you will see that in this more ethnomethodological way of thinking, a task is not a task. A task has to be defined as a task, and the students need to engage with that. And there is always some what you can call local contingency at stake for the students, which can explain also variation between the students and how they perform. So that was short introduction to what I will do. So I have divided in three parts. This is kind of just the introduction, and then I will have a second part which I have called theory and analytic stance. But first I want you to look at the two animals that comes up when it comes to cuts of beef. So you would think that if you have an animal like this, they will have the same names, they will have the they should be cut in the same way, but as you see, this is partly a joke and partly a categorization exercise. And the reason for bringing it to this little event is not going into this kind of business, but to see that in every workplace, in every social type of organization, we will have different ways of categorizing the activities, and that's what also we do in when we do research, that we slice up the phenomena in different ways. There is a philosopher called Ian Hacking. He says that social science is as real as natural science, at least in its effects, and that means that if you're looking for the thick rib, you will actually find that, but you will only find that in Britain. You will not find it in the US. So categorization for me is a very kind of deep an important issue in what we are doing, and affects how we understand a phenomena. Then I will do a few slides on theory and analytic stance, and then I will stop and move into a short conversation around that. I can put it quite bluntly, I think the most frequent understanding about the sociocultural perspective is that we do not measure things, and that we are only oriented towards processes and so on. That's not the case either, even if there's some people in the sociocultural camp that is not about, they don't want to measure the phenomena and so on. So I think the more scientific reasoning around this is that sociocultural perspective is constituted by what I call three different genesis. And the first one is the ontogenesis, and that's the individual development. And that means that, of course, we have then individuals with specific that's engaged in specific social and cognitive processes. But the ontogenesis is really about how the individual perform specific tasks, and those and that performance is, of course, influenced by the microgenesis and the sociogenesis. But it's very important that in the sociocultural approach, as a kind of a theory and analytic stance, if you're interested in the individual, you would do your analysis on the ontogenetic level, so to say. So that's, I think, very important. And in some of our recent studies at Intermedia, we use pre and post tests, for example, in which we try to make a decent measurement of how students or adults develops over time. So that's how we try to capture some of the ontogenetic processes. The microgenetic term, you will find that both in the Piagetian work and in Vygotsky's work, and it's one of the most kind of classical terms that you will find in the field of learning theory, but also in child development. What it actually means is where you can say, in a simplistic term, microgenesis is where you look when you want to study talk, what people do together, what they do with technologies, and so on. So the microgenetic term, when I discuss with my more cognitively oriented colleagues, we kind of align that we need to pay attention to the microgenesis. The question becomes, what kind of details do we want to include in the concrete analysis? The sociogenesis may be a more less familiar term for many people, and that's a term that's important in this type of analysis, because you can say that when you come to a workplace, like in some of our cases, a specific artifact that contains knowledge about hundreds of medical experiments, that's something an artifact and knowledge that's not owned by an individual. It's actually owned by the community, to put it that way. So the sociogenesis, what you may translate that into, is the kind of historical development that become crystallized in the specific types of artifacts. And then in the sociocultural camp, people use different words of that. Some people then call it technology, some people call it resources, so it could be quite confusing. But the sociogenesis is the kind of accumulation of knowledge over time, and it's crystallized out in an artifact that could be a text, that could be different things. But you also can say that when you look at the students' engagement in the school, that would be kind of the rules for turn taking that's built in the institution. In a workplace, it could be the how the actual work is organized. We will find that in the division of labor between different types of experts who have the scientific authority. If you move into a hospital, you will see that the physicians, the doctors, is responsible for the diagnostic and treatment. Nurses is the interest is responsible for more the caring aspects and so on. So the sociogenesis is built into people's behavior in specific ways, and it's developed. And the interesting analytic exercise is to see how these three layers is played out in relation to each other. So that means that there is no kind of what you can say, it's an analytic choice what you want to do when you do this type of analysis. As a researcher, you choose the object of inquiry, so to speak. This analytic stance that I'm talking about as the sociogenetic perspectives, you will find similar but not the same way of approaching a phenomena as the sociogenetic approach. You will find it in sociology, in what we can call symbolic interactionism. It's origins from the Chicago School of Sociology in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And you have a number of leading authors there, Herbert Blumer and others. You can find somewhat similar in critical psychology that usually originate from the old Russian school of psychology and also in Germany at a certain point. They will also be interested in the relationship between the society and the individual and how this dialectics is moving back and forth and so on. And then I think you have the more kind of famous version of critical theory, at least in psychology. You have the cultural historical activity theory, and you have the triangle models proposed by Erio Engström that has received a lot of attention also in the learning science the last 20-25 years. And I think the especially critical theory and activity theory is what I would call more structuralistic oriented approaches, and they have specific features that they want to emphasize in the analysis, dependent on what position you take on them. And then you have ethno-methodology, which is, I think, the article by Christian Greifenhagen is a good example. He said that he's inspired by that, but he's not a kind of clean ethno-methodology analysis. And then you have a number of different cognitive perspectives. To me, the most important thing in all this kind of theorizing about things is that we, as empirical researchers, we need to define the unit of analysis, if that's an individual, if it's dyads, if it's groups, if it's an organization. I mean, also to define what I will call the level of description. And the level of description is sometimes not mentioned that often in the discussion, but I think is equally important. For example, in analysis in the workplace, in the article, we focus mostly on, I would call, the content of the talk, but not the actual interactional features or the linguistic details, which is a deliberate choice of what we want to focus on. So the two terms, unit of analysis and level of description, is important. So to say a bit more about the analytic stance, so what in the sociogenetic approach, what we are after is the what I will call the as is the sense making. So where to start is not that important. That's dependent on the phenomenon, the question you want to raise. Generally speaking, we see that the context is something that's dynamic. It's not given per se. So we don't try to fixate the context. We try to look at what we can call the multiple layers of the context, the historical aspects in artifacts, how people interact, but also how individuals participate in a specific type of discourse interaction. And so this multiple layers of context is quite important in the analysis. And then we try to, as you've seen in the article, look at specific sequences of actions. And those sequences need to be representative within in relation to the phenomena that we want to discuss. So that's very important. The term meaning it's ambitious to kind of use that term, because the philosophers struggle with that term and have been struggling for the last, I think, hundreds of years. I'm quite specific about what we mean by meaning here, with that we talk about meaning potentials, and that means that if you work in a digital resource, for example, with estimation of software systems, there is specific meaning potentials built into the resource that the participants need to work with, and the meaning is not given in itself, but had to be talked about, elaborated, and so on. So it will get a specific meaning in the context, but that doesn't mean that meaning could be used in any kind of way, because there is a history behind every concept. So the kind of the space around the concepts is very important to understand. So even if you can say word and sentences are essentially vague and so on, the history kind of make limits for how you can use a specific word or specific concept. So that's also a very important point of view. So I'll summarize this little theoretical exercise is that in the sociogenetic perspective, and that's on slide PowerPoint number 9, in the sociogenetic perspective, we are interested in the kind of the cognitive aspects, which could be related to prior knowledge, what knowledge that's become relevant for the participants and so on, but we are interested in that on the individual layer, the ontogenesis. And then there's the social interaction, there's ways of reasoning, and some of you was interested in the kind of argumentation, scientific reasoning and so on. And then that's on the interactional level. You can also measure the outcome of those processes on the individual level if that's what you're interested in. And then we have the institutional layer, norms, organization of knowledge, expectations and so on. The question that I always ask, and I ask the group that I'm working with, is that what's the adequate reduction? So what do we want to explain and understand? And I think that's always very important to ask those kind of questions. So the adequate reduction is kind of a key term when we turn this into a methodological issue and say, what do we really want to focus on here, what do we want to try to understand and explain. So to make a break here, I would like to stop here, and then ask if there is any questions about the introduction, about the sociogenetic perspective, about the concept, or if there is methodological implications of the and I will come back to that later anyway, but I think there is a good time now for having a short kind of break in this in the presentation, and hear if you guys have anything that you want to raise up to now. Okay, so my interpretation of the chat log is that first, it's good that Frank is translating somewhat to the German language, so there is you can see the relationship between the how this is labeled in English. And so that at any point, if you want to interrupt me, you can do that. There is not more people in the conference, that would be okay. So please interrupt me. I see there is no questions so far. So that could mean different things, to me at least. So, but I can start moving into the to the article, and if you have read that, it may be points where you want to discuss specific details. And don't feel shy of asking any kinds of questions, because I've been struggling to understand this for the last 20 years, so there's a lot of issues that you can wonder about. Okay, the actual article or the book chapter, as you see, is written as a part of a discussion. What about the how can they understand the relationship between learning and creativity? To me, the the term creativity is maybe I'm overstating this, but I think it's often used as really as a buzzword, so it's difficult to understand what people actually mean by when they talk about creativity. In the educational system, for example, we talk about the creative subjects, which means music, art, and so on. And I can say in my school period, I was definitely not the very creative students in those subjects. So so what creativity means is really an issue. So I think that's really a word that will need to be used in a careful way. And as you see in the article, we started with the knowledge sharing as a kind of premises to understand that before you can be creative in the professional field, you need to ask other questions. So we asked kind of questions that what's at stake for the participant, what counts as knowledge, what could be considered as creative here in very specific workplace contexts. And we think that's important because then it's easier to make a judgment if these acts of the participants actually have any creative parts at all. Then I'm moving on to PowerPoint number 12, the key concepts. In the sociology of science studies, the term expert cultures have been around for quite a while. And it comes among, it has been developed, I think, in both the sociology of science, but also in studies of technologies, in more and more, what you can call, in very advanced research environments and among professionals. And one of the leading authors about the expert cultures, the what you can call the knowledge culture terms, is the German sociologist Karin Knorr-Stettina, which I think have done very interesting work around that concept, both in CERN in Switzerland, and she has studied in biologist, and she has studied in the financial market in the U.S. and so on. And she used some of those terms, expert cultures, knowledge cultures, and so on. But she used it also in a quite varied way. And the other key term is that we have this term infrastructures of knowledge, which when first I saw that term, it felt like a kind of very slippery term. When you start to look for it, it's more obvious what it can mean. So when I work at the medical faculty now, for example, we see the physicians through technology can access data, they can access summary of journal articles, they can access a lot of what I call the accumulated knowledge from different positions within the hospital structure. So that means that they are surrounded by infrastructures in which they can use. And I think as researchers, we often overlook that aspect, that we are surrounded by different sources that we need to put together. But we need to align those resources to each other. So the term infrastructure is here used in a quite specific way, about what kind of resources exist and how can they be linked together under different circumstances. The infrastructure about knowledge grew out of, I think, a lot of research that looked at first at particular sites, and then you couldn't understand the site, it actually looking across sites. And you see, especially in the review article of Health and Technology by Fitzpatrick and Ellingson, they're starting to advocate that we need to expand the unit of analysis quite a lot in order to understand how we implement ICT systems. I find that statement quite problematic because you can also study particular sites in detail and understand the three kind of layers, the ontogenetic, sociogenetic, and microgenetic processes which is involved. So to just to expand the unit of analysis is maybe not a solution to many problems. But I think the term that we use a lot in the article is the local contingencies, is that even if there is very strongly and a standard that can restrict the actions, every standard would need we need some work that's specific and that need to be articulated, and there need to be consensus, not consensus around that, but they need to be articulated so the different experts can actually articulate their different positions and potentially agree. And we find that in our cases that that's not a trivial process. So the local contingencies is a very, very important concept in the article. On the PowerPoint number 13, we just list the three cases that we draw on in our work. So this chapter was written more as what you might call theoretical ambitions, but it's more like an argument that we problemize the term standards in different contexts and ask ourselves what kind of work is needed in order to make a standard work. So we looked at the risk auditing, we looked at clinical guidelines in a larger hospital setting, and we looked at the estimation teams that plan huge IT projects like the new pension system in Norway and so on. So those were the three case studies. And as you have seen from the actual text, we also reviewed other fields as well. But we reviewed the field from a specific position that we want to have to get a more deeper insights into how a standard was actually used. So that gave us a kind of the way of sampling in when we reviewed literature from different fields. So the research questions we asked in this paper was, how do professionals share and develop knowledge when they're exposed to new standards of work? And in what ways do these practices involve creative and explorative actions? That was the research questions. So we wanted to get close to the actual work, or what some people call kind of practice studies, and to see how people actually engaged in these types of activities across different expert cultures. In the first case study, and the order is not the same as in the chapter, the risk auditing system we'll call the CART, that's PowerPoint number 15. That's a typical software that has developing over a number of years. The version we look at here was called the CART 3, and it nothing to do with the philosopher, by the way. Is that it's the Norwegian Institute for Public Accountants that's responsible for that, and it's used by 75% of the institute members. So it's hundreds of accountants that actually use this, and they see this as a support system for the performance of work, and it includes includes specific standards based on methodologies that's accepted. And I don't. If you remember the Enron scandal and another financial scandals, especially in the US, that's what we hear about, is that the accountants in some very prestigious company didn't follow the what you can call the many of these procedures. So it's not, this is not a kind of trivial issue in the world economy, so to speak. If you look at PowerPoint number 16, you will see screenshots of the actual work environment. So the what's really important here is the key word that you will see in the transcript on the right hand side. Where the interviewer say, do I understand it correctly if this assertion describe what you do when you perform the audit control later on, that you look for completeness and validity, and then you can look up to the right hand corner where you see some of those boxes in which you can tick. So the assertion is a key term in which signals what you need to control. And then you see later that they talk about the cruise to Amsterdam and so on. So there's a lot of the information in the system in which the accountant doesn't need to control. So the really important part here is that they need to decide, even if they have all the information, which aspects of the firm's activities that they want to control. If they want to control that on a high level, if they want to control it on a medium level, and if they want to control the details, if, for example, people have sent in the right information about the cruise in Amsterdam and so on. So by paying attention to the to this assertion, we can get a deep insight in how the accountants reason together with the work, the system that they work with. So that's very important. And even if this is kind of a co-located setting where they reason with the CART system, the CART system actually works across sites. So we don't need to kind of follow the person around. We can follow the person's work with the CART as a digital resource and try to understand how they reason when they use that system. So that's one of the arguments for not necessarily paying attention to how people move, but you can actually follow the system. In the PowerPoint number 17, it's a couple of interviews data where in which the auditor explain. So they explain how they work with the system and the kind of what they need to control. So, for example, in the second excerpt, they say, in this case, it's a family business, and I will then check who is in charge of the three different shops they run, where settling cash holdings and the like is concerned. You'll soon discover who is well organized and who is perhaps not so organized. So you see that the kind of the human judgment here is equally as important as the digital resource, but actually it's the interplay that's interesting, because the accumulated knowledge partly rests in the digital resource, and then you can see how they use that to reason with and how to control the different businesses in which they are responsible for controlling. So we saw that the cart was seen as a kind of as a work infrastructure that connect information, specific types of knowledge, standards, and work procedures. At the same time, the infrastructures needed to be recreated in specific ways in each audit task. So even if you have all that information, the local contingency need to be filled, so to say, through the auditor's analytic actions. That could be more or less routine actions, but it could also be quite cognitively challenging actions that would need what we have called creativity with a little C type of actions in order to be able to work within the system. And it also we also looked at that new and experienced auditors had problems when they trying to understand the specific concepts and the procedures in the CART system, and it was very important for them to have access to more experts in order to make specific judgments. So what we can say that the CART system is mediate an orientation towards the standard of risk of thing itself and how it should be understood. And it's always an oscillations between the kind of generic aspects of the auditor's work and the very specific one if you want to control the specific action. So we see that that's the even if the system looks very close, there is a lot of cognitive work needed to make it work according to the auditing system. Our second case was constructing clinical guidelines, and that was partly coincidence that we got that case. It was built totally new, very cool high-tech hospital just outside Oslo. They had robots, they have every new technology that I think can be worked out in that period. What we wanted to look at is how they kind of was making their practice evidence-based. And one way of looking into that was looking into how the procedures was established. And I think they had approximately little less than 250 procedures that they need to work out. And as you see from the papers, it was quite a high number that they didn't agree about, that they really needed to work through. So that's where they started to work, and they had a group of senior nurses, but also physicians from different departments and wards assigned to kind of to do that work. And for us, this was really interesting because it's very seldom that you get access to these kind of internal debates about how evidence for actions in a hospital is constituted. You need to get quite close to the actual procedures to do that. So the key term that was used in the analysis was a term called local universalities by Tim Munsenberg, which I think is a very interesting concept, because they say it's not that you strictly have evidence and you more or less have local practices. It's actually the interplay between the generalized knowledge and the local knowledge that's the important thing. And if you don't account for both, you will actually miss the point. And I think that's very important if you study different professions type of work, is that you can't, you need to capture different forms of knowledge which is in use. and not focusing on either theoretical knowledge or practical knowledge and so on. So you need to capture the, in Tim Munson-Berg terms, the local universalities. And if professions only built on local knowledge, it's very hard to to understand that they actually can build up an evidence base. So the general aspect or universalities is an important aspect of for professions to work upon. The as I said, and here it's on the PowerPoint number 20, the findings. It was 80% accepted directly. That's not that many. 72 commented on, and which need to be tailored. And 10% that was rejected. So here you can say there is an example that by choosing the looking at some of the commented and the all the procedure that was rejected, we get an analytics. The technical analytics stance in which we can analyze how the participants was negotiating and integrating multiple forms of knowledge. So that's why I would say in this workplace studies it's difficult to find a one point where you try to fixate, but it's possible, but you need to know the practice where you kind of start to do the analysis, and then you can kind of work on that. So the analysis of the standards in the hospital find was very interesting. The last case study, and after that I will kind of sum up, and then we can have a conversation around this study, is that the estimation in teams, and this is in software teams. And I think in the newspapers, in the media, and I think around us, is that it's very important to control the costs of building new software system. And to do that, there's a specific activity that one can study, and there's a number of international journals on that term, which is called estimation. And that means, in other terms, that you try to predict what kind of resources that you would use for a specific activity. In this case, the estimation, of course, is dependent on both social aspects, the communication among the members, and the cognitive aspects that the student, the participants bring in. So in these teams that we did studies of, you can have project leaders that have been doing programming and estimation work for 15 years, and they're high level experts. You can have nerds that almost comes out of a lower or an engineering school with just a couple of years training, but has been worked as hackers or whatever for a number of years. So you can really have a very much asymmetrical team that all have knowledge about how to actually do the work, but they have to agree on this in the planning phase. At a certain point, the research team and then more kind of consulting firm was developing what they call the planning poker, and that literally means that all the participants have a card. They have actually five cards, and when you put up zero, it means that number corresponds to a number of hours of work. If you put up one, there's another higher number of work hours, and so on. So the project leader run these meetings, and then they say, okay, for this phase of the work, how much work do you think we need? And then all the participants put up their card, and if there is consensus, some of the participants have to articulate and reason around why they think they should spend 50 hours and that should be enough. If there is differences, the meeting leader, the project leader, asks the different participants to articulate their understanding of the work processes. And this was a very efficient way of for articulating differences, different assumptions, different content point of views, and so on. And it seems a little bit almost childish when we looked at it first, but after going deep into the analysis, we saw that this was a very rational way of dealing with process in which you try to control. When we analyze these cases, I think there is three points that's really important in the findings. And the first one is interesting because there is a communication principle in the communication in the field of communication by Grice, who suggests that participants communicate what is needed to get the conversation going, to further the conversation. And that's interesting if you compare that to in other settings. So when do we maximize the efforts of being understood, and when do we minimize it? And I have some. I think this is interesting. How we then, if you have this principle, what do we expect of participants or what they are saying in different situations? We find that the participants did not use any technical terms as long as the conversation flows smoothly and everyone in the group seemed to understand. But when it comes gaps and conflicts, they use technical terms to define and to create frames of relevance and so on, which I think is really important because if you don't need technical terms, you don't use it. So what we find, what's I think at the surface, a lot of microgenetic constructions that looks like everyday assumptions. But if you look deeply into that and had follow a trajectory, we see that they use the technical terms to in order to close the gaps and so on. And I find that a very interesting that finding. And in the beginning, was quite surprised, and after a while, we saw that this way of moving between not using and using technical terms was very important to also to have certain efficiency in the in the actual work. The findings from these three cases, and this is what generally is called in is analytic generalizations, if you want, and that could be a mystical term to someone, but it's often used in qualitative studies. So I want to highlight on the PowerPoint number 23. First of all, the second point, formalization, it seems to be the case for all three groups of professions that they formalized and was building collective knowledge through tools and procedures. And that's quite important. And it has implication for how you build the kind of co an infrastructure of knowledge. It seems that the professionals kind of use their conceptual understanding and what we have called epistemic reflexivity in order to solve gaps and conflicts and so on. And we saw that for all of them, the kind of the artifacts in which they used in their work was very important because it was a constant move between the historical understanding built into the artifacts and the work that they did here and now. That's why I think this term local universalities is very tempting because it's actually gives you a good view of how professionals move between different forms of knowledge. So that's I think quite an important term. The analytic stance, as you see in the article, we then use the onto micro and sociogenesis in a specific way to analyze, to identify that each professionals brings specific knowledge to the team. They are not the same. That knowledge is very important to create the microgenetic constructions. And we also saw that there is in the institution there is all the institution there is specific norms for how to behave in specific settings. So I would say in the analysis that we did, our strength is that we have is able to kind of to get hold of the micro genetic construction. The three cases varies a bit in how I would say substantial the analysis is on the ontogenetic and the sociogenetic layer. But we wanted to show in the analysis that the microgenetic constructions is dependent on both the sociogenesis and the ontogenesis, and to kind of to flesh that out so we make an adequate reduction of the phenomena. So the conclusion in the for this article is that standards come with meaning potential. That's PowerPoint 25, but they do not determine. So it's not that it's you can follow it blindly. It has to be realized and enacted in the professional work. So our conclusion is that it's important to study how professionals realize standards, and not only how a standard may look like in a piece of software and so on. So it's how they align to the to each other, the reasoning and the artifact, and that the at the digital resources is important to understand how professionals can make use of collective knowledge, which is nothing they alone has developed, but that they can use the knowledge that's developed by other professionals and kind of reuse, reinterpret, and so on. And you actually, as Google Scholars says, you can stand on the shoulders of giants, which is a good term. And it's very important that how then you use the collective knowledge for particular purposes. So that's why we thought that this work was very interesting to do, and to then to kind of unpack what professionals do in these types of situations, and how they use standards and so on. I have listed, so I will stop the kind of the content there, the content presentation, and then I have some questions. It could be, and I've listed several several issues about what kind of is the rationale for the study, what's the aims, is the premises clearly spelled out, the cases, what functions do they serve. Is the analytical concept used in an adequate way? The conclusions, are they valid, and so on? And what kind of research contribution is such a chapter? I would argue it's a contribution, but it's, I mean, it obviously can be discussed what kind of contribution this is. So so I think it would be good to now to that I stop talking for 1 or 2 minutes, so you can mobilize, and then you can ask questions, come up with comments that you find relevant, and don't be restricted to the issues that I have been listed here. So I will stop the my talk, and then give you 2 or 3 minutes to mobilize questions, comments, and so on.
So, if I may, I go first. I have several questions. Well, first, thanks for these interesting case studies. We had a discussion with Jim Greeno earlier on in this series, and we were discussing about an aspect that knowledge is more or less always for action, and actions have goals. And I wonder what the role of goals is in getting from the meaning potential. So there is a standard or some planner's knowledge or theoretical knowledge that someone puts into a situation, and this, well, if I understood it right, this creates only a meaning potential. And then the question is, how do people come from a meaning potential to their actual meaning? What is the role of their goals then? Is that isn't the role of goals that I have with a specific in a kind of situation very important? Just one example: if a planner would have the idea of creating a very efficient group work situation, but if my goal in that situation as a group worker is to have, let's say, very efficient periods of work with large breaks for giving me the opportunity to smoke my cigarettes or do something else or watch television in between, then I have I have different goals, and this is then creating the actual meaning in that situation. Well, am I completely wrong with that perspective or interpretation of what you just said?
No, first of all, I think that's a very important question. I think when I said that, we tried to vary the what you can call the unit of analysis between the microgenesis and the ontogenesis, that we in some of the studies we want to capture the what you can call the orientation of the different participants. So in especially in the analysis of the software teams, we analyzed the teams in somewhat details about if we can find different orientations among the members. So we didn't use the kind of the goal term, but we used the orientations because what we saw is that if there was a large difference between the different orientations, the teams didn't reach any consensus in how they were going to the plan for the system. So I completely agree that there is an individual element in between the kind of the meaning potential and the meaning realized. Said that what we saw that it. When we analyze the data, that these goals is not static; they are kind of emerging during the over in process over time, and that's also where we find there is quite asymmetrical relationships. That the like the more experienced the experts is pushing the processes and the kind of the emerging goal structure quite a bit, and they also correct some of the new members if they're not kind of aligning to the actual planning process. So we try to kind of capture that as orientation and as emerging goal structures, and you will find people in the sociocultural approach like Jeff Sachs when he analyzed students' mathematics achievement, that he actually paid quite a bit of attention to the goal structure as well. So I think that's a very important point. So the question is how detailed you want to capture that among the individual, and how you want to capture that as an emerging phenomena in the group.
So we also discussed about another issue, and this was about the little z creativity. So here at LMU, together with Daniel also, we wonder, or I wonder also, what is the role of this little z creativity, or creativity with little z, however you want to call it. And so the question is, is it just about kind of flexibility? And if it's so could it be also located in the professionals or in the experts? What might be hard for using the knowledge in a flexible way? Or do you always need another person to bring in this kind of creativity into a group? Yes, what's the role of it? Is it, and also if it's a general skill that someone has, and would it be something that could be trained in the beginning of a professional development, or is it something that someone has or doesn't have? So maybe you could elaborate a little bit more on that. So we would be very interested about it.
Okay, that's the toughest question that you can ask. First, we did go through quite a bit of the research about the creativity of the author that I will not try to pronounce even about I'll just move the computer slightly here. Okay, I'm back. That's a difficult question because the literature, if you look at the what kind of popular literature about that people are in flow and so on, that's really not based on interactional data. It's really based on interview data, quite a bit of that. And then you have the creativity literature that's look at what you can call the big heroes in the field. And then, as you say, can we locate this within the individual? Is it a general trait or is it an ability and so on? And I think that's a really difficult question because in our study and in other studies that I've seen, at least when you speak about creativity with little c, it's get validated by other members if this is a new creative solution and so on. I think it's difficult when we have these types of case studies that we do to actually decide on if this is a more general capacity that's developed within the individual. It could relate to if to risk taking and a number of other aspects. So I think that that's for me is still an open question. I think what we find interesting in our case studies is that we see that as also Keith Sawyer had I think elaborated quite a bit, is that this creativity is emerging in specific types of interactions. And that they, in the short term, need to be validated by other persons, need to be recognized. And you can say that if any of you write a totally new genius piece about CSL research, it also need to be recognized by the community. So you can say that the article by Jeremy Rossell from 92, for example, or maybe 94, it's very important a piece of CSL research, but that's not by the text itself. It's also because it's been recognized by the community as a very important contribution. So I think for me the term creativity is quite slippery. That's why we decided to kind of use the term creativity as little c, as also Robert Sternberg and others have labeled it, it could be small actions within a group in a certain group session that's is able to highlight aspects and then contribute more to the conversation than others. But I'm not an expert in the more psychological theories about creativity, so I shouldn't make any claims about that. I'm sorry that I can't be clearer on that aspect. I think it's a really hard question to address.
Then may I ask you to elaborate a bit more on the method side of your work? So how did you do the case studies? You know that I'm approaching CSL research from a different perspective, and what I really appreciate and I really find it great to have such a rich set of results integrating three different levels of analysis, if you wish, or the different genesis perspectives. And I think what I often miss is what is the method that is used. I know that you mentioned a couple of perspectives at the beginning, but if you could give us a little bit more of a feeling for how this is done in the case studies. How did you do that? Have you been alone? How many people are needed, for example, to identify these, what I found fascinating, the concept of the local universalities. So how do you identify local universalities and how would you, do you try to generalize across cases? What is the what are the steps that you take there?
Okay. First of all, I would like to say that in the work that I do now and that I do did also together with people at the research group Intermedia for the last three or four years, enabled to kind of to do this multi-level analysis and not this. Not in a statistical sense, we have started to use more and more of pre and post tests so that can control for the individual, I wouldn't say gain, but for the variation between in a certain population. And then we have used those pre and post data as a way of sampling out excerpts that could give us a specific angle, for example, how and that has not been in workplaces, but that has been in schools, and then we can sample excerpts in which we can go deeper into and try to understand how specific students run their processes so they develop in for some students then very robust conceptual understanding and for other students a less robust understanding of the of a specific phenomenon. We have done that in geometry, we are doing that in science studies right now and so on. So and then we have what we can call rich description of the actual context. In the workplace studies we have done it a bit differently. We have tried to identify, like in the hospital structure, a fixation point in which you can't really discuss. There is more or less 250 procedures that need to be filled with content. There is kind of objectively given that there is a 10% rejection, and then we kind of sample from there and then follow the conversations, the discourse around that. And for that study, it was one PhD over approximately 2 years and one senior researcher in the risk auditing study. It was one PhD and one master student, and then a senior person that was doing that study over more or less over 2.5-3 years. And in the estimation study, that was a full PhD study over 3 years. So you can say that in all these case studies, at least involves a full-time PhD student that actually doing a lot of the work. Then I have been and then we tried to use the same analytic framework through the this tree genesis to be able to see if we can use this as a kind of a analytic frame to understand how these processes are at interplay. You can say that's one of way of exploring how you can use that type of analytic stance. And I think we have taken what we are good at Intermedia to analyze social interaction, and then we have tried to expand the analysis in the both the onto and socio-genetic to the antigenetic layers. So you can say we have really kind of played with the methodology here to be more and more advanced in the two other layers as well. And usually we try to combine two, but maybe not three in the same study. In this particular chapter, the aim was actually to configure a new types of analysis where we looked at this across, where we let the kind of the case studies speak, so to say, but still analyze the data within the same framework, which was quite demanding to do. But I think also the three layers helps us reanalyze the data and then kind of address the issue of standards and standardization. So in work hour, it's you can say that each case study is not that doesn't create many PhD students, but you need some resources to do solid case studies. So what you don't see in the text is also that there is a lot of there's a lot of other interesting issues going on, but here we have done the kind of the sampling of the data and the analysis to kind of get to respond to the questions about standardization as a specific topic that's interesting in organizational studies and also in, I would say, learning studies in the workplace. So I think that addresses a few of those aspects that you want some comments on, but not all of them.
So if there are no other immediate questions, I would like to ask my webinar questions, I would say, that we ask all of our presenters. I think one of the questions you already partly answered, this is connected to the PhD students, and the question, given your approach of analysis and also the focus on workplace learning, what would be your recommendation to PhD students? So turn it around, it's not how many PhD students you need for such a work, but what can a PhD student do to use methods and concepts in a meaningful way in his or her own research? So this is question one. And the question two, I think in this case, for me, even more important, is the question, how do you think this topic of workplace learning is related to the learning sciences, and why is that important for the learning sciences, given I think that it is currently not a very prominent topic in, well, if we look into the Journal of the Learning Sciences, I would say still we have 80% or more papers on student learning in schools or informal learning, but still of youth or children outside of school. But workplace learning seems not to be very prominent. So why is this the case, and why should learning sciences maybe invest more in this area?
Okay, for the first one, I think what's different in the workplace studies, and in if you do studies from schools, in some ways, to do a PhD, if you want to study learning in the workplace, is maybe a bit different, because if you want to study this in a naturalistic context, like in the workplace, it is very, very difficult to kind of manipulate the context and try out, for example, a piece of software, to test out, for example, you can't really test out a new division of labor. So if you want to do a PhD study in a workplace setting, I would choose a kind of a case study approach in which I went into an organization that could be private, public, that was engaged in implementing, for example, new technologies on their own initiative, and so on. So I would then follow the kind of the rhythm of the firm for a certain period. So And I think that's possible. I think we have some PhD students that have done case studies in which they have done intensive periods of observation, and they have done interview with the participants, and sometimes I wouldn't call it measurement, but we have asked the participants to perform certain tasks and so on. So I think it's for a PhD, it's definitely possible to do a kind of a learning in at a workplace study, but I think I would be very, very careful to choose particular sites according to certain criteria and so on, because I think it's way more demanding than doing this in a school in which I think we have a broader repertoire of kind of methods that we use. Another issue is that the it's more difficult to do, I would say, appropriate measurement of in the firm, because it's so many factors that you need to address. I think first of all, we don't have appropriate measurement when we do workplace studies, and as you see, the health review hardly have any kind of hard facts or findings from measurements, which I think is a symptom of the field. And in my view, this is the weak point of some of these studies, that we don't have any baseline data that we can then use to see if any kind of intervention actually work out. So I'll myself the next 1 or 2 years look at interdisciplinary work, and I will look particular for methods of measurement so we can measure certain progress over a certain time. I think that's the so if you are a PhD student, you shouldn't move out on very risky business. I would do kind of case studies as a main approach for at least for PhDs. If you work with your supervisor and the team, you can of course do different kinds of studies in where you involve different types of measurement and so on. So to do studies of business environments is quite different than doing it at school. I find it way more complicated than educational studies. The second question about learning science and workplace studies. To me, that's very. I think it's important because I think the when you read studies of in very high stake journal like Organizational Science and a number of organizational studies, many of them use the term learning, and I would say either knowledge acquisition or knowledge creation in a very, very slippery terms. I think if, and I think that's the case if you move to more sociological studies, they use learning as an everyday term. For us that really are engaged in learning studies, we want this to be a deep scientific term, defend based on a certain theoretical assumptions and so on. So I think the it's a lot of the literature in organizational studies that use learning just as a very, very loose metaphor. So to me, I think that's why I think it has been for the last 15 years of my life, and I think also for the next 15, I will engage myself partly in workplace studies in which we try really to use the term learning in a much more scientific way based on a set or a theoretical assumptions. And I think we have a lot to contribute within understanding how people learn, for example, new skills in a firm, in a specific firms and so on. So I think as the learning science CSL is the kind of the only society that I know about that really deals with learning, learning as an analytic concepts in an analytic way and not as a buzzword when it comes to workplace studies. So that's why I think it's important that both the learning science, the CSL community, kind of sometimes move out in these settings and actually show analytically what these concepts can do for us in our understanding of how a workplace is operating. And I think if you look at, for example, Jo Engström studies of work in workplaces, he has been able to demonstrate that. And you don't need to take the activity theory approach, but you'd see that he has been researchers that takes learning seriously and developed his concept of learning by expanding, which have done a huge impact in the in some parts of this more kind of organizational sociological studies. And I think the reason is that he has been able to specify those processes through the learning concept and in his way the learning by expanding. But I think this will be possible from a more cognitive point of view as well. So I think that I think that when we use the learning concept as an analytic tool to understand people's behavior, I think we really have to, we can contribute a lot to other fields than kind of learning in schools and in higher education and so on. So I think that's my more missionary approach to the question.
Okay, thank you for your missionary answer. I think it would be a timely thing to maybe work or go for a special issue also in the Journal of the Learning Sciences on workplace learning, also to position that topic, because I completely agree with what you said on the relevance also of an analytical approach to learning in organizational fields. And well, we have been discussing that before, that maybe the focus on school and school learning also had to do with funding situations in some bigger member countries like the US, whereas in Europe we had some focus always also on workplace and professional learning. And that would also mean that to well appreciate that research efforts also more in the learning sciences. Okay, final round of questions or final round of comments, and then I'm afraid we have already to close that session. Final round, maybe, if someone would like to say something or ask a question, that would be the last chance. Otherwise, we will stop here, Stan should have the final word, and then we close the session.
First of all, thank you to Frank for organizing this. I think this some of our PhDs at Synth Media take part in some of the seminars, and I think they heavily appreciate the possibility to take part. And thank you for the participants to take part today. If you have any questions or want some advice on some literature and so on, so either within the next week or in a period of time from now, please don't hesitate. I usually answer my emails within a day or two, so please, if you have some questions, I can do my best to follow those up. And maybe I will see some of you in Boulder, Colorado within the next 2 months. So thank you for taking part.
Hi, Stan. Thanks a lot for the presentation. It's been very interesting, and I understood your article way better now that you explain some of the details of it. So thank you very much, and perhaps we see each other in Colorado. Bye bye.
Thank you for the session. Probably I will be bothering you in my research.
Thank you very much for the session, and I'm looking, and we are all looking very forward to follow on discussion with you.
Yeah, thank you very much for the presentation.
Goodbye. Bye.